You guys are pretty quiet tonight. Is that the quiet of thought, or the quiet of restfulness, or the quiet of preparation for complete quiet? I'm not sure which way it'll be. Look at the great passage in Hebrews chapter 6, verses 9 through 12. And it is a wonderful paragraph that we have to think about tonight. I'd like to try for us to place it in the broader context of this letter, of this epistle. And one of the ways that I do this that I think is relevant maybe to our relationships with each other, and certainly what we try to do in teaching or working together as with a group of the Lord's people, is to notice that in this letter, the writer will, there'll be a word of great encouragement, and then there'll be a pretty firm admonition or warning, and then there'll be, right after that, an even greater encouragement than the first one that was started with. You think about that pattern here. Here's an encouragement, here's a strong warning, and then here's an even stronger encouragement. Why do you guys think he does that? What is there about encouraging that causes him to approach his message this way? Can you identify? Notice what I'm saying here. I'd write it on the board if I could. There is an encouragement. Then there'll be, it seemed like a little bit stronger warning each time, and then an even greater encouragement. Why does he do it that way? If you've raised children, you should have some idea of why he does it this way. If you have tried to think about having an impact on them, Becky, what would you say? Say it loud. All right, Becky says that the encouragement at the beginning is to open them up to the warning that he's going to have to offer, the admonition, and then the next encouragement is to build them back up again from what they've had to think about. There's the danger. Anybody else? Brendan? All right. If all you do is warn over and over and over, that would tear them down so low that they wouldn't be able to do what you're asking them to do. That's a good point. Anybody else? Does this have anything to do with placing the warning that you have to offer in the context of love for the persons you're trying to help? Yes, I think it does. And then for the persons that you're trying to help, as Becky gets at and what she just said, there has to be a sense that this is not being said to me because I am because there's no one has any confidence in me, or because I'm likely to mess up, or because I can't do what I'm being asked to do. If you're going to ask somebody to do something, they have to think they can do it, or else it's a waste of time, isn't it? I think that might be part of the idea. So I noticed that the idea is, tell somebody what there is about it, you love them, then offer the note of criticism or warning or whatever it is you got to offer, and then tell them again how much you love them. And for a parent who's ever had to try to discipline a child, that's an important thing to bear in mind. And then in our working with each other, that's an important thing for us to bear in mind. Now, there's another thing I notice about the way the writer of Hebrews goes about the process of encouragement. I think that there is a noticeable kind of contact or correlation between step one or section one, section two, and section three. I think there are parallels between the instruction or encouragement and the warning that helps maybe each helps us to kind of take each one related to each, to the next one, and it helps us to see what's going on. For example, the first one of the warnings was don't drift. Be careful that you don't drift from what you have heard. And the correction to that, if you remember in chapter 2, you remember what it was? The way to avoid the problem or the danger of drifting away, just not paying attention and heading off into danger. What was his fix for that problem? Remember? It wasn't magic. It was a pretty basic thing. What did he say? He said, pay more careful attention to what you've already heard. Give more careful thought to what you already know, in other words. What he says, the second problem in chapter 3 is the hardening of the heart. And he used Israel, the hardened heart, the hardening of the heart. He used Israel's conduct in the wilderness as his example to that. And the danger that he has in mind, he specifies in chapter 3, at verse 12 and 13, where this evil, unbelieving heart happens gradually as a person is hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, verse 13 says. So what was his fix or his answer to this one? All right, exhort one another every day, or encourage each other day by day. This day by day part, or this daily part, was an important idea, because the other problem happens gradually. Therefore, this requires some constancy about it. And then the third problem, if you notice, and that we've just been reading about in chapter 5 and verse 6, is an immaturity that leads to falling away. And this we read about last week, and then Sunday also, but please notice there in verse 6 of chapter 6, that here is someone who's had all these blessings that he's enjoyed or experienced, and then he falls away, or he turns away from the living God and renounces the faith, as we discovered on the Lord's Day. And the problem, the answer to this one is really what we are going to what we're going to think about tonight. I'm going to shorten it by saying that the answer to this one is instead the pressing on to maturity, or the growing, or the showing of the same kind of diligence that he talks about here, that you'll see as we go along tonight, I think. But diligence, earnestness, and really the full assurance of hope is the answer to that, to the problem here. Now, that I think is, you kind of see, drifting leads to a hardened heart, and the hardened heart, if it's allowed to go on, leads to a falling away from God, from which there is not another Savior that's going to come along. Paying more attention, encouraging each other, and being diligent or earnest in our efforts to serve the Lord prevents this. This is not going to happen where this happens. And the main thing I was trying to get at, if you were in the class on Sunday, is this doesn't just sort of happen to somebody who's trying to walk in the light. It's not, you're not going to commit the unpardonable sin just sort of slipping up one day when you've been trying as hard as you can. This is talking about a settled way of thinking that develops, and this is the antidote or the preventive to that, that has the plus, this leads to many rich blessings that the writer calls better things. Now, there's a couple other things that we should do probably to set this in context before I read the passage. Please notice that this whole section is occupied with the problem of sluggishness. Look at chapter 5 in verse 11, where we've got a lot of things we want to say about Christ, the high priest after the order of Melchizedek, but they require explanation, and you have become sluggish. You've become dull of hearing, he says. Dull of hearing. Now, skip down to chapter 6 in verse 12, and notice that he says, so that you will not be sluggish. It's the same word in the original language. So this whole section is bracketed by those two statements about this problem. Now, in between, there is both admonition, and now there is the encouragement that starts at verse 9. I'm going to read verses 9 through 12. I'm going to ask you first, what do you see here that you think is instructive about our task of encouraging each other? See this right here? So if that's what we're supposed to do, and if this paragraph is a great example of doing that, what could we learn here first about actually being encouragers to each other? Helping each other against the danger that he's been describing. He says, but, beloved, we are convinced of better things regarding you, and things that belong to salvation or accompany salvation, even though we are speaking in this way. For God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown toward his name by having served and by still serving the saints. And we desire that each one of you demonstrate the same diligence so as to realize or to the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you will not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and endurance inherit the promises. Now what do you see there that might be a lesson in how to encourage first? John? All right, it's like in Philemon, where what John is saying is that we are convinced or we're persuaded of better things regarding. We have confidence, and that I read that word confidence or convinced actually comes first in this verse in the original language, where it tends to start with verbs. We're convinced of better things regarding you. Anybody else? That's the opposite of, I knew you wouldn't, or I knew you couldn't, or you never do, or you always do. That's the opposite of that. Anybody else? All right. Notice that it's based on who God is and what God does and what God is like. It's based on the nature of God in that way. Very important observation. And I think especially in God's family, for what we say to encourage each other to be based on what our Father is like is an important thing. Anybody else? Something that we could learn here about how to encourage. Ron? All right. So that's a important point too, Ron. I found out this is the only time in the entire book of Hebrews that he addresses his readers as beloved. He does it as brothers a lot, but beloved, why at this point, right after the strongest admonition or the kind of most solemn warning in this whole book, would that be appropriate? Well, it reinforces his affection for them, and it lets them know that he's not trying to tear them down. He's trying to help them. And also, he doesn't think they've reached that place he's just talked about where it's impossible to renew them again to repentance. That's an important part of this. Anybody else? He gives them credit, doesn't he? One of the important things here is they have served the saints in God's name. And what do you see at the end of verse 10? We'll comment more about this in a moment. But have they quit it? Have they left it? No, they're still doing it. They are weary, but they're still working. And he gives them credit. Encouragement always gives somebody credit for what they are doing before it tries to help them do better, or else it will just come across as criticism and nothing else. I noticed that that remembering what they've done. Have you ever had somebody walk up to you and remember something that you've done before positively? What does that do for you? Why is that important and encouraging? All right, it shows that all that time when we got tired and we thought nobody pays any attention and nobody remembers and nobody cares, it shows that that was wrong. And that's an important part of encouraging. There's no good encourager who doesn't do that part of it, I think. And then notice that he expresses a desire for them. This idea, we're persuaded better things of you or concerning you or regarding you, that's important. He holds a positive goal up for them. Encouragement recognizes the danger, but it also is giving them something to shoot for or to try to aim for in their lives. And then notice he gives them examples. Y'all see that? In verse 12, that'll be really important in the book of Hebrews. Out of all the books of the New Testament, that becomes a really important part of this. So, like, if you can take your boy, if he loves sports, if Brendan can look at Devin and say, "Man, you shoot like..." Who would be the great shooter? Patrick Beverly or somebody? I'd say a left-handed one if I could think of one, Ben. A positive role model, a positive comparison is a really helpful thing with this. Now, any other observation just on the nature of how to encourage that comes from that? Anybody? If not, let's look through the text now and observe what he's saying here. "But, beloved, we're convinced of better things regarding you," is a contrast to what he's just said in verses 4 through 8 in the previous paragraph, where because of the problem of immaturity, someone could gradually lose his interest in the faith at all and then turn away from all the good things that God had given him. And instead of being ground that brings forth vegetation and good fruit, and when it's blessed from God, then it could turn into ground that just yields thorns and thistles and is worthless and useless and ends up just being burned off. That'd be an awful fate, but this writer says we're convinced of better things. We believe you can press on to maturity. We believe you can You can respond to God's gifts, verse 7, producing good fruit, and you can be blessed from God by that. That's what he's getting at, in my opinion. And things that belong to salvation. What does salvation mean? Rescue. All right. It means to be rescued. Rescued from what? Well, rescued from sin and death and all of those kinds of forces that are rescued from Satan's slavery. And the hopelessness that goes along with that. But there are things that go with salvation. There are things that accompany salvation. There are things that belong to being rescued from God. For example, if you're rescued from Satan, from slavery to Satan, what goes along with being rescued from slavery to Satan? Being a servant of the Lord. You can't be rescued from slavery to Satan and then still remain under the influence of Satan. Or if we are a people who are made into God's family, then we should live like God's children and begin to take His character into our lives. If we are people who are rescued from hopelessness and given promises, then he's going to say that we should pursue those promises all the way through. So from the start, he is telling them, we've been saying some hard things to you, but it's not because we're disappointed in you, and it's not because we don't think that you're saved or that God can bless you or that you can make it. That's the point. He's treating them beloved, like beloved in that way. I want you to notice the connection between beloved in verse 9 and each one of you in verse 11. Why do you think that connection, there's the connection between those two terms might be important? Talking to a whole group of people and you say beloved to them, which ones are you talking about? All of them, right? Each one of them. He has an individual. He has said back in chapter 3 in verses 12 and 13 that encourage one another every day. Verse 13, he said. That's how. And then in here, that same individual attention also goes on, and he's wanted. Verse chapter 4 and verse 1, he's wanting them to be careful lest any one of them come short of that hope that God has given them. So that individual care has been important through this letter also. Now, all right, what is there that makes him think these better things are possible here in this passage? One is, God is not so unjust as to do what? I'm going to put it up here this way. God is not so unjust as to forget. Right. God is not so unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown in His name. So God is not someone who just forgets. That would be unjust for God to ask His people to serve in certain ways, and then they do, and then He simply ignores it or forgets it. A companion to that is that God is aware. God is just. God doesn't forget. He doesn't overlook it. He doesn't ignore it. Can you think of some other passages in the New Testament which teach that point about God's attitude or the Lord's attitude toward the service of His people? All right, one, that God is faithful. Remember what Jesus said? If someone gives a cup of cold water to one of the Lord's little ones or one of the Lord's servants. What did he say about that? All right, you be blessed. God won't overlook that. The Lord won't forget that. What Jesus say about if you visit the least one of these, my brothers, you have visited me. If you that kind of care for his people is also care for him. It's not overlooked or forgotten in that way. We've talked a minute ago about why that might be an especially encouraging point. And then notice here in this statement, God doesn't forget their work and their love. So I want to jot this down up here. This means effort that he has noticed, and this means the motive behind that effort that he has noticed. You see that? God knows what his people do in his service. He knows why his people do that in his service, and both of those things turn out to be really important to him. Then notice in verse 10, at the end of verse 10, that this is a statement in which what they are doing for God is also important. So the idea is, what's encouraging is God is fair and won't forget. God is aware and pays attention to it. Therefore, what you do for God is recognized. So I like to try to think of it in that way. What you do for God is recognized. And I'd like for us to think about for a minute the end of this verse here and the two statements that are made. The Hebrew writer shows that he, as well as God, both he and God are aware of what they have done in having served. What does that mean to you? Having served the saints, they have done it. They have been doing this at some point in the past. They have been engaging in work. That means hard work, effort, and expressing love to the saints by serving their needs. And it could be in any, over in chapter 10 of this letter, some of these needs are going to be mentioned. And I might just flip over there to remind us of it for just a moment. It says over there, verse 32, remember the former days after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made a public spectacle through insults and distress, and partly by becoming companions with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizing of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better and lasting possession. That might give you some idea. They have engaged in sacrificial serving the people of God in the past. That makes it understandable why they might get tired and why they might get worn out about it, doesn't it? But look at what he says here. And by serving the saints. What does that mean? Having means past. Serving means what? They still are in the process of doing it, which in my mind, I think, well, the church is working and serving and caring for the saints. They're doing important work. God notices, and And it's appreciated and encouraged. So why be worried about them giving up? And why be talking to them about the danger of being hardened and falling away and drifting from what they've heard if that's going on? What do you think? All right, so it's not just people who have completely quit that need encouragement. They need encouragement in order to keep them doing this and for it to their effort to be valued and for them to know that. I ran across a quote, an observation by William Barclay. You guys are familiar with Barclay's little daily Bible study books. Greeley, I know you are, and some of you are. I think this is an insightful observation by him. He says, these people have never given up their practical service and their practical help to their fellow Christians. They have been and still are active in service of God's dedicated or holy people. And there's a great truth here, a practical one. Sometimes in the Christian life, we come to times which he calls arid. Do you know what arid means? A-R-I-D? Dry, John. That's right, dry. The desert times in our lives. He says, sometimes the teaching that we do in Sunday school or the singing that we do in church or the service we give in a program becomes a labor without joy. At such a time, there are two things we can do, Barclay says. We can give up our attendance and our work. If we do that, we're lost. We can go grimly with it. And the strange thing is that if we do, the light and the romance and the joy will certainly come back again. In the arid times, the best thing to do is to go on with the habits and the routine of the Christian life and the life of the church. If we do, we can be sure the sun will shine again. I don't know what you think about that, but I do think there are days when we come and we do what we can because we know we should. There are also days when we come and do what we can because we love it and we can't wait to do it. I don't think that's different from life in general, with a job or with your house you live in or your family or whatever, or with yourself. There's sometimes you just look yourself in the mirror and put up with it because that's who you are, And I think that Barclay's point is important in that way. So go on with the paragraph with me. And we desire that each one of you demonstrate, what does he call for here? I think this is revealing in terms of encouragement here. Is he asking for a huge, big change, an overwhelming overthrowing change in their life? What's he asking for? We desire, here's what we want, here's what our intention is. What is he desiring? Show, all right, the same earnestness, the same diligence. What is he giving them credit for there? All right, being diligent to start with. They have been and are that. And he sees signs maybe of them getting tired and the decline in that. He wants them to show the same total zeal, the same deep care, and the same diligence in this way. He wants them to do it the full assurance of what? Of hope. To the full assurance of hope. What you hope for is the goal, and the full assurance is that what you hope for is worth it, and that's what gives life to the effort. That's what gives diligence to the effort that you put into it. Now, across the scope of human endeavor, there's a truth here. You have to have a goal. You have to believe that reaching the goal is worth it in order to put in the effort it takes to get there. And that's true whether you have a ball team or whatever it is. It's true for us and our work together too. We have to have something we hope for, a belief that it's worth it, and then it matters to us enough that we give diligence to it in order to get there. Notice again how in his encouragement, he's not scolding them, he's calling them to a higher level. He wants them to press on the upward way, that idea. And how long does he want them to have this earnestness that's born of a full assurance of hope? How long? To the end. What does that mean? Oh, until we can't do it anymore. All right. Until we get there. What? Christians don't retire. It means that we keep on running our race or finishing our course all the way to the end. This becomes an important idea in Hebrews all the way over into chapter 11, as we'll notice here. Just think about this a second now. If you do this, he says, you won't be sluggish. This is a positive antidote to the danger that he's been talking about. They won't be lazy in this. You'll become imitators of those who do what? Right. Imitators of those. They do inherit the promises. But look how he says they do it. He says, imitators of those who through faith, and I'm reading here the New American Standard Version, I think maybe the word, as I understand it, the word for endurance or the word for patience in physical circumstances is a certain word that's not this one. This is the word for long suffering. So I'm gonna just compromise and use patience, if that's all right with you guys. I think it's talking about patience with people more than it is hard circumstances. Who through faith and patience inherit what? The promises. Now, good positive examples. It could be Abraham, as is in this passage here. It could be the people who are great examples of faith in chapter 11, or it could be your leaders, those who taught you the gospel in chapter 13. That could be all of it. And either way, what he is doing is including his readers in a company of people, not the company of people who had all these blessings and then fell away and crucified Christ again to themselves and put him to an open shame, but a group of people who with interest and with assurance and hope kept on serving all the way to the end like they already had been doing. What a heroic group that would be. Notice in this passage, there are the key words of this letter. Promises, faith in those promises, patience, and hope. Or long-suffering and hope. Promises, faith, hope, and patience. Those become the core principles of this, what this letter is trying to say. We're going to need to think about what the promises are here. and what the hope, what hope is, what's the nature of this word, and what's the substance of this word. And we'll try to do that in this next big section. And this next one, how many of you in here have ever enjoyed "Will Your Anchor Hold," that song, "Will Your Anchor Hold in the Storm of Life"? Man, I love that song. Well, this would kind of be where that thought comes from, this next section. And so if you're in here in our Sunday morning part of this series, we'll try to take a detour and look at this this idea on the Lord's Day. The next big word for who Jesus is to us happens. He is the pioneer or the captain of our salvation. He is the author or the source of it, and he's our forerunner next, the forerunner of for all of us who's in heaven at the right hand of God. We'll look at that the Lord's Day. Appreciate so much you guys being with us tonight, and try to find somebody to encourage this week, even if it's yourself to start with. I'd like for us to have a word of prayer together before we go. John, you mind to stand right there, John Davis, and just lead us in prayer if you would.